The chicken fighting began. I don't recall now whether Gad got our chickens entered at this moment or not, but in any event, the affair had just gotten well underway when we were raided, and most of these men were herded in. Well, of course, Andy and myself were experts on rapid motion under such circumstances, and we were terrified, and we just squirted out into the forest there and got separated and hid out. And I hid most of the afternoon, I think it was, and finally it all seemed quiet, and I began in Indian fashion trying to get back, see how to get out of there. I suppose, of course, our horse was gone, our little two-wheel cart was gone, and finally I encountered this shadow of another party, and there, really in Indian fashion, I scouted him, and it developed he scouted me, and after about an hour of this, we found out that it was my chum and myself, and we were the only people left up there. Then we met, and we were very much disturbed, rather terrified, as a matter of fact, that we'd lost the horse and the cart. And so we decided we'd go over where the horse and cart was, and we found the horse was right there grazing. We'd removed the bridle from his mouth and put him out on a long lounge. And so we got into the cart and came down the mountain. And I didn't get home until about 1 in the morning. And I got in the house without waking my father up and slipped up to my room, and my mother immediately appeared. I might explain that she had a very powerful influence on my youth. And I think in the first place, she was not only a woman of character and great determination, but she was a woman of great understanding. I told her everything I did, and she never corrected me, because if I told her, I realized it was wrong, and there was no use in telling me again it was wrong. And I told her what it was, and she understood that. And she had quite a sense of humor, so she didn't give indication of it verbally herself very much, but she was a very appreciative listener. Now, I remember in this case, I was describing to her why I didn't get home till 1 in the morning when I'd left the previous morning. And I told her of the escape from the chicken fight, hiding out through most of the day up there, and finally finding Andy, and then being terrified about the horse and the cart, then finding that, and then coming home and arriving at 1 in the morning. Parts of it she thought were very funny, and I remember she laughed or she cried. And nothing was said about reprimanding me. Didn't need to reprimand me. I was not going back to any other chicken fight and go through that experience again. And she didn't tell my because if I told her, I realized it was wrong, and there was no use in telling me again it was wrong. And I told her what it was, and she understood that. And she had quite a sense of humor, so she didn't give indication of it verbally herself very much, but she was a very appreciative listener. Now, I remember in this case, I was describing to her why I didn't get home till 1 in the morning when I'd left the previous morning. And I told her of the escape from the chicken fight, hiding out through most of the day up there, then finally finding Andy, and then being terrified about the horse and cart, then finding that, and then coming home and arriving at 1 in the morning. Parts of it she thought were very funny, and I remember she laughed or she cried. And nothing was said about reprimanding me. Didn't need to reprimand me. I was not going back to any other chicken fight and go through that experience again. And she didn't tell my father, because he would have been severe and would have corrected me. And for that reason, I wouldn't tell. But of the contrary reason, I told her literally everything. And she was always rather glad to hear. Sometimes she may have been worried. Sometimes she may have been ashamed. Sometimes she may have been shocked. But she heard what the matter was and what the affair was, and whenever there was any humor in it, amused her very much. I remember one occasion as an example. We were copying the ways of this gang in the mountains, and we had air rifles, and we went out in the country, and we would go through the motions of a holdup, by letting the buggy, generally of a farmer, pass, and then getting into the road and shooting at the rear of the buggy. Well, in one of these buggies, the little isinglass window was absent, and our BB bullet went through the window and hit the farmer in the back of the neck. And we had one of the most thrilling escapes that we ever went through. Only was the thing was we could run faster and roll under a fence faster than he could. And we got away. But we were afraid to go home. So finally, we turned our coats inside out, turned our hats on backwards, and made ourselves as conspicuous as possible with the feeling that we were now disguising ourselves and returned home. But my mother thought that was one of the funniest things she ever saw when we showed up in this disguise, as we call it. But we were afraid to go downtown for about 2 or 3 days, and she protected us against any questions that might be embarrassing to us. But that was my sole holdup, and it ended up very, very tragically. Now I'm trying to think of things in connection with Uniontown that would be of interest to you. The development of the town, during my younger days, went along very rapidly. The streetcars came in, I guess, when I was about 14, and I was fascinated with that, as the other boys in town were. There was the train already going through, the Pennsylvania Railroad and the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. They were branch lines, both of them, because it is a very interesting, very valuable coal region, and for that reason, the railroad connections built up much more rapidly than they otherwise would have. But as I say, in my earliest day, we were spared the curse of coal smoke from the coke ovens because they hadn't begun to develop close in to the town. After I got through this little early school, to which most of my companions went, and I went to the public school. We were very hard up at that time, so my father took me to the public school, and I remember the agony he went through when the superintendent examined me to see what room I should go into, and I failed to answer the obvious questions. I could see then that I'd make a very poor showing on these present programs where you win $100,000 or $10,000 or any sum like that for your answers, and these children of 7, 8, and 10 star in their performance. I was very poor in school. My sister insists that this is not true. Mrs. Marshall insists, though she only has hearsay to go on, that it was not true. And the legend at home is that it is not true. Now, the actual facts of the case are it was true. I didn't get along at all well in school. I never learned how to study till I left school and went away to school. And I had a very painful time in the public school because I was ashamed to admit my ignorance, and so many in the room knew these, particularly these arithmetical problems, so quickly and so much better than I did. If it was history, that was all right. I could star in history. But the other things, I was very, very poor in. Grammar, I knew nothing about. Arithmetic, I knew nothing about and still know very little about. It wasn't until I went away to school that I learned how to study and began to put up a performance. And my first year away at school was very poorly done. I think I was 35th in a class of about 150 or thereabouts. And my last year I was 5th. But I was developing that and learning to study. And finally, when I went off to the staff college and gave a year in a very intense competition, which has become compared to the Prix de Rome at the Sorbonne in Paris, and in those days was marked down to the hundreds and thousands of percent, I finally came out one, but it was a terrible year to me. But it fixed the habit of close study that I had never really gotten up to that time. So we've had many arguments about this in which they think I'm putting on a front and saying that I didn't do well, but I had a very humiliating career in school, except something like history. And I was very much ashamed of it, but I did nothing about it. My father was very impatient about it. My brother was very impatient about it because he was an excellent student. And what really changed me a good bit was I wanted to go to the VMI. And he had gone. He had finished. He'd done very well scholastically and unusually well in the course he had elected in chemical, and started the pursuit of chemistry in his earliest days connected with the iron furnaces. But when I was begging to go to the VMI, I overheard him talking to my mother, And he was trying to persuade her not to let me go because he thought I would disgrace the family name. Well, that made more impression on me than all the instructors, parental pressures, and anything else. And I decided right then I was going to wipe his face, as we say, or wipe his eye. And I ended up by at the VMI. As I say, I was fifth at the end. My general stand was only about 14th, but that took in this year when I was 35th. And I was the senior cadet officer. I was the first captain of the Corps of Cadets. So I did finally get ahead of what my brother had done, and that was the first time I'd ever done that. And there's where I really learned my lesson. But the urging came from overhearing this conversation, and it had quite a psychological effect on my career. Now, some more things about the pleasant little life we lived there in Uniontown. I remember there were only two pool tables in town. One was in the beautiful home of a great friend of mine who is near here now, and one of the few remaining companions of my youth, if not the only one, in her house. And hers was a fairly modern house for that day. And the other was in a house of one of the oldest families, and the nephew of this judge who owned the house would invite us there to play pool. The room was a little bit constricted, which interfered with some of the shots. And I played very poorly because I found I had very poor hand coordination, which has persisted to this day. But what interested me in the pool room was there was a painting of Christ with a crown of thorns on his head. And I unfortunately made the observation to the nephew of the judge that I thought a painting of Christ with the thorns on his head in the pool room was a rare combination. Well, this was repeated to the old judge, who was a very severe character, and he forbade me the house from then on, so my pool education ceased right there while all my friends could go and play. And I learned early in the game the lesson of keeping your mouth shut, unless you've thought of very particularly of what you're going to talk and who about and who you're going to talk to. I might tell a very tragic and interesting thing about this old gentleman, this old judge. There was a branch of the railroad that took off near the station. I think of the Baltimore, Ohio Railroad, maybe it's the Pennsylvania Railroad, and crossed one of the nice streets of the town, pretty far out. They had tried to get the railroad to put a watchman there, or to put a gate. They didn't have those gates in that day, though, I must say. But to put a watchman there, because you couldn't see the train because of a cut, and it rolled right out over one of the principal thoroughfares where there was a great deal of traffic. But they were stopped every time, largely by this old judge, because he was a heavy stockholder in this road, and he was for keeping down expenses. Now, I'm telling this thing from recollections of my youth and what was hearsay to me at that time, a very small boy, and it may be quite wrong, but nevertheless, this was my understanding of the thing. So he opposed the installing of a watchman at this crossing. Several people were killed there. And finally, tragic enough, the old judge was killed himself with a silk hat, as I recall, in connection with some attending some church function, which I thought was a very tragic result of this unwillingness to put a watchman at this corner. I recall this other railroad that the lesson I learned from that, which crossed not far from our home and took off part of our grounds and an island in the creek, which I valued very highly. But they had to cross the main highway, which, as I've said, was the National Pike. The town was opposed to their crossing the highway or was unwilling to let them do it unless they paid more money. I don't know which. I expect the latter was probably the case. But anyway, the railroad had all these hired laborers in all sorts of clothes, good and bad, water with oatmeal in it for them to drink, which I got 25 cents a day for carrying at times, and they couldn't get across this National Pike. And I remember that there was a complete stalemate there, And first thing I knew, the railroad crossed the pike in the night. And when morning came, they were in possession of the route through the town, which has lasted ever since. When I went back there and went over all this to remind me of my youth, I found it was largely under a 20-foot fill, and I couldn't recognize anything very well around it. They had buried my youthful associations there, as I say, under a 20-foot fill. There was another thing that made quite an impression on me, which really only in an abstract way relates to the town. But one of the friends of my youth was a black terrier, short-haired terrier, named Trip, T-R-I-P. He was the owned by a boy friend of mine who played with me practically every day. And Trip always went with us. He was devoted to us, and we to Trip. A couple of other dogs formed part of the gang. One celebrated dog named Towser, who afterwards he discovered had three names and boarded the three hotels. I could give a description of him in detail, but I don't think that's appropriate to what we're talking about. Anyway, this Trip business is a little bit. I came back for a very brief visit to see my mother, who still was at home, when I was the second lieutenant, I think after I'd been in the Army about 3 years or 4 years. I went up to Tripp's home. His brother, his owner, I think, was dead then. And the owner's old mother was still living there. And I went in to visit her and then came out, and Tripp was lying on the stones by the old pump in the sun, and his black coat had burnt almost brown. He paid no attention to me. He didn't bark at me. He was so old, he was just indifferent to me. Well, that was quite a blow, because Tripp was one of my close companions of my youth. So I sat down on this long flagstone that was around the pump and succeeded in petting him, though he resented it in a way and was rather unwilling, and I talked to him quite a long time, trying to renew my youth, and very much distressed that he couldn't remember me at all. When after, I suppose, 5 or maybe 10 minutes, he took a little careful sniff at me. Then he sniffed at me 2 or 3 times, and then he just went crazy over me. He'd finally gotten a scent in his old nostrils, and he remembered me, and that was the most flattering thing that occurred to me on that short visit home after many years of not being there. Now, I'm always surprised now when I think of the various places I showed up at Uniontown as a boy. As far as I can figure out, I seem to have stuck my nose in everything. I remember getting in to see the hanging of the only man I ever heard of then being hanged, and getting into the funeral in some way through the courthouse. I remember so many particular exhibitions. I remember the first exhibition of long-distance telephones, when they had about 20 phones on one board, and you could come in and talk to Chicago or wherever you elected. And I, of course, talked to Chicago, which was quite an event in my mind. But it was the introduction of the long-distance telephone, which was just entering to my life at that time. I must have been about 13 or 14 years old at the time. By a little subtraction, you can figure out when that was. The circuses of that day, of course, I was deep in them. I arrived at the circus train, watched it unload, and got out to the circus, and my main occupation was getting in without paying for it. Then the thing that very much absorbed the attention for 1 week a year of my chum and myself was the state fair. They called it the state fair. Whether it was the real state fair or not, I don't know. But it had a half mile racetrack for trotting and pacing animals, and a few running, but not many. It had the midway plaisance of that day, where you put your money down and watch the wheel turn around and stop at the Alaska Diamonds or the Revolver or the Alarm Clock, which appeared very large in our eyes, or you bought the 10-cent paddle on the wheel, where you won $1 if the wheel stopped at your number, and all of that sort of thing. There were a good many different gyrations to the plot. Well, we arrived at the opening of the fair before the things were put up. We saw everything put up. We saw every snare involved in it. We saw how the man could control the thing and dupe the credulous guests. And having all this knowledge, they had to, we indulged in what you might call a refined blackmail. They would have to allow us to win the big prize. But we would take it back till we got to the last day of the fair, and then everything we won we kept, and we'd hide it. And we had a great time there. But what has stuck in my recollection was a brand new wooden tub with sort of a light wood on the inside, with nails all around on which were hung tin cups, and that was lemonade, and all you could drink for a nickel. Well, that was the best lemonade I've ever tasted. I've never tasted any since that just touched it, and all you could drink for a nickel. But the trouble was, we tried every way we could to drink a lot, but they wouldn't allow us to pause. And after we got to a certain point, it developed this pain in your temple, and you couldn't drink any more, and then they'd take away our tin cup, and we had to produce another nickel in order to go any further. But we had a lot of interesting things, and we learned a lot about such things during that period of our experience at the fair. Another way of raising money was to get into the grandstand and then crawl out the back and sell the pass ticket we got at a reduced rate, which is a nickel instead of a dime, and then crawl out the back again. My father caught me at this, and I was very severely reprimanded and not allowed to do it anymore. We knew the stables intimately of the various horses, some of the owners, and could have advised betting pretty well, but we never became involved in that phase of the matter. Altogether, it is a very enjoyable sort of recess in our life in this small town. Unfortunately, we didn't have a river or a very large stream in which we could do swimming, so we had to swim in ponds, out of which I finally got typhoid fever. It wasn't until I went down on the Ohio River in Kentucky at my father's and mother's home in Augusta, Kentucky, that I learned how to swim. I remember I had a very amusing uncle, rather a man with a very keen sense of humor and a devilish performer of practical jokes, who used to go down with a chair down the grade, as they called the beach, and watch me learning to swim and splashing desperately and trying to keep up for a few feet. My last years at home were in a private school, which only had a short life. It was built up by a very brilliant man, but one who was not very good on a business affair and was very apt to become diverted by other things. He was very handsome, very popular, beautifully educated, but he was an uncertain quantity in the world. Afterwards, some people from home, some of the men, met him in Paris with two very lovely women, and he cut them dead. He ran the school, and had a number of teachers, and I remember when it broke up, there was no money to pay the teachers. That, I think, was my last school experience there. I thought the years of public school were not very long, but they were very valuable to me. I think every boy in a democracy should attend for at least a period on public school, though I must say the teaching is often far below par and creates considerable difficulty if the boy tries to go to a very high-grade school where he has been intensively instructed. But the democracy of it is very important, I think, in the life of every young American. I think working, ordinary work, is very important. It's pretty difficult for a wealthy boy to do, but if the parents can get him away where he has to go on his own for a while to make his own money, to find his own job, I don't know anything better for you as a preparation for the roughness of life and the necessity of understanding life as it is lived in a democracy and among the particular kind of people with which you are associated. The development of the town was very rapid after it once got started, it seemed to me, and the first great move was putting in the streetcar line. The next one was paving a good bit of the street. I didn't like that at all because my father made me wash the street with a hose, and I had to wash both sides of the street, both my chum side and my side, and the streetcar track. And I had to do this in the morning right after breakfast and before school. And all the other fellows going to school and the girls all made fun of me. And, of course, that's very painful to any young person. But I had to do it every day. We had a number of dogs, two or three hunting dogs, and Towser, our famous pet. And when we went to taking our meals during days when we were having difficulty with a serving question, which was very difficult there, I had to carry home scraps from the kitchen of the hotel, and this was a very painful, humiliating performance for me. However, it contributed to my education, though I didn't enjoy it at all, and was always sort of a black spot on my boyhood. The dogs were very interesting. My mother was very fond of them. We all were. Several of them were very fine hunting dogs. Towser, the old fellow who had every kind of blood in the world in him, was a very curious citizen and a very fine one. He would take my father to his train when he'd go down to the works, the coal and coke works, and he would learn in time when the other train came back, and he'd meet him at that train. He took my chum's father, who was president of a bank, to the bank. When he would go at 7:30 in the morning, he'd meet him for lunch, and he'd take him back after lunch, and he'd meet him when he went late at night, and he would often stay at the bank till 11 or 12 o'clock. But Towser was always there to meet him. Towser had very famous fights with a bulldog. The bulldog got the best of it when he clinched on Towser's neck and ear, and afterwards this ear became quite a problem with his state of health. But he stayed with the bulldog, and finally they dragged the bulldog off, killed. And the bulldog belonged, incidentally, down at this place on the banks of the creek where I saw the ducks in my first view of the world from the ladder in our stable. We played a great deal in the country. My Andy's grandfather had this very valuable farm, which they farmed in the splendid way of those days, and was very profitable. It was underlaid with coal, but they didn't mine it. The next time I saw it, it was just 2 or 3 years back, and it had been ruined by the coal veins being taken out from under it. But then it was a very rich farm, and when we would go out there, we would be allowed to sit at the table with the harvest hands and listen to the conversation of the harvest hands, and Andrew's old grandmother would help wait on the table and help with the cooking, and they were very wealthy people. And later, Andrew's father became one of the richest men in western Pennsylvania. But his grandmother was very well-to-do, but she worked. She helped the maids in the kitchen, and she waited on the harvest table, and the masses of food these men ate, while it didn't impress me much as a boy, I look at it now and think where they got their appetites and where they got the food and how they could eat so much. You all washed out in the yard near the horse trough, and you had a tin basin, and there was one little broken mirror and an old comb, and you'd slick your hair down and make it sort of curl around on your forehead. But that was the way you got ready for lunch. And then the conversation at the table seems to me smack very much that I get in the westerns I read of the cowboys in the West, where they're always making fun of each other and dressing down one of their members if he in any way seemed to brag about any particular achievement of his. They were always tearing down a fella and making little of him to the immense amusement of all the others. But I never heard of any fighting or anything of that sort. I learned a little about farming because I helped with a great deal of it. I helped as far as I could in the barn, and they had a beautiful barn. I helped out in the fields with hauling the hay shocks. I helped distributing manure on the parts of the land which showed from the lack of crops in that vicinity or the grass that it needed refreshment. And I learned a great deal about it, without really being conscious of the fact that I was learning. And of course, when we got bicycles, which was an introduction during my day, we could go there much more frequently. And we were always rewarded with whole pies. And that was a wonderful thing. Going back to the bicycle, I first rode, and very briefly, the tall bicycle with a little wheel behind it. And most of the time I was on my nose. And then came in the safety, as they called it, which had spade-like handles and a hard rubber tire, and was a very heavy machine. And then very quickly after that came the inflated tire and the light machine. And I learned to be very expert in changing the tire because we had a great many punctures. Dunlap was the first pneumatic tire of my youth. And I think the Dunlap patent made a great fortune in this country as well as in England. But that came in during that period, and that changed the life of the countryside very much because we could now motor out, we could ride out on our bicycles quite a long distance, and picked up things that seemed very distant and very remote and was unheard of until I got into the bicycle service. I remember so well getting on the boat on the Monongahela River at one point. We had ridden to that point and were about exhausted when we got there. And the river bank or beach was covered with pottery, which was there to be loaded on the boat, uncrated, just the pieces of pottery of various designs and types. And on inquiry, and it took quite a bit of inquiry to get this straight, I found out that that all resulted from a Swiss who had settled in that part of the country and became a very well-known statesman. And he had brought with him the Swiss industry of making this pottery and had established there at a town called Geneva. And I didn't know that Geneva was named from Switzerland, and I didn't realize that this pottery all came from the knowledge of these people who came from Switzerland, settled in what was called Geneva, and where this beautiful place was built up by glass something or other, who was Secretary of the Treasury, I believe. Anyway, he was involved in the purchase of Alaska, and he was a very able statesman. And the beautiful place he built still stands and is still occupied and was purchased by my chum Andy in later years when he became a well-to-do man before his father's fortune and his fortune crumpled. All of these things developed certain steps and the population of the town was changing. It was about 5,000 as I first knew it and as I recall. And I don't know what it could have been at the time of the stages coming through the National Park on their way from Baltimore to Wheeling. The next stop was Brownsville, by the way, which was the birthplace of two very important men, James G. Blaine and Knox, who afterwards became Secretary of State, Attorney General. But Brownsville was remote from me. It was only 12 miles, but you practically never saw it until we got bicycles. And then I saw Brownsville a little, though it had been as remote as the dodo from the earlier activities of my youth. In this respect, I remember being visited by 9 boys while I was Secretary of State who wanted to see me regarding a plan they had for feeding the poor boys in France or otherwise in Europe. And I saw them because I thought that was unusual. And I thought of my own youth when all these places that are so familiar later on were just maybe matters of history, but certainly not places that I had ever visited. And when these boys came, they had all been dandied up in their Cub Scout uniforms, and they had all had their hair cut, and everything was freshly starched. And I invited the press up to hear this interview, but I didn't tell them what it was, and they were very much incensed that I dragged them upstairs for 9 boys of about 9 years average age apiece. I seated them at a table. I didn't know yet what they wanted, and the boy on my right told me that they wanted to give this money that they were going to make, and they had yet largely to make to the a fund for the poor boys in Europe. And they had gotten the use of a movie, and they thought they had the borrowing of a theater, and they were going to put on this special matinee and invite all the school children, mothers, fathers that they could get them, and others, and they wanted my endorsement. That was all he said. And I remember complimenting him on the completeness and yet brevity of his statement. They didn't appreciate just what that meant. And then I got to thinking at that moment, just at that moment, of what a contrast that was to my youth. My radius of activity at 9 years old didn't go as far as this Brownsville, which is 12 miles away on the Monongahela River. It went up into the mountain because we summered there. But it didn't go over 5 miles from home, I don't think much. I had only heard of Salt Lake as a tale of history, and not very serious history at that age. I had heard of San Francisco, of course, the Golden Gate, but that very briefly. I had never heard of Manila, and I'm quite certain I never had. And Pittsburgh was the furthest point, and that is because I was taken there with my mother shopping when she went to the city, as they expressed it. And I'd gotten down to Kentucky, to my father's home, but I don't believe I really got there till I was about 12. And anyway, it is a very restricted, circumscribed area in which I lived. Now here were these boys talking about Europe, and 9 years old and raising money to feed these European boys who were really on the verge of starvation. So I described this all to these boys, what my youth was like in contrast to theirs. And if I do say it myself, at the moment I talked pretty well because I was rather moved with the whole contrast. And then I went in to the present day. I first described the short history in an international way of our country as we knew it. The fact that we never had an ambassador in this country, nor an ambassador that we gave to another country until very late in the development. And at the time of Dewey's Battle of Manila Bay, there wasn't an ambassador credited to the United States, or did the United States credit an ambassador to any other state. We were hardly noticed except as having a Wild West. I think most of the information about us related to the Wild West, the buffalo, the magnificent hunting, and things of that sort, and the sort of wildlife they thought that we led. New York, of course, was in touch with a few Europeans, and Boston, and maybe Baltimore to a certain extent, but not much, and Charleston and Savannah, and San Francisco, in a very brief way, with the Western Pacific. But it's hard to realize now how limited was the United States at the time of Dewey's Battle of Manila Bay. And there began our international involvements, however you may term them, whether we want them or not. And that is the international beginning, in a way, of the international history of the United States as I see it. And it developed very quickly. And there were very serious political campaign battles in regard to it, notably the Democratic campaign in regard to the development of the Philippines and the Republican campaign in connection with the development of the Philippines for, as they said, its eventual return to the Filipino when he was in a position to govern himself, which he certainly was not at that particular time. All of this happened in that period of my youth, and I can recall so well my father walking up and down and discussing the dispatch that just came in about the Battle of Santiago in Cuba. I recall equally with that going down to the 8:15 train in the morning and getting the newspaper, which I wanted to read more than my father and mother, but they both wanted to read it, which gave the description of the fight between John L. Sullivan and Corbett. And later on, when the telegraph would give the news of fights, I remember waiting outside the window of the telegraph office where they read the messages aloud to us, Corbett-Fitzsimmons fight. And I remember a discussion there to this day between two men who were arguing about Fitzsimmons. Fitzsimmons, who won the fight in the 13th round, as I remember. They announced the winning of the fight when we were getting the 11th round. And then we had to wait to get the remaining three rounds. And these men were now arguing about Fitzsimmons, who was the national hero of the moment, and just of that moment. And this man was insisting he was a great American, and this other fellow says, no such thing, he was born in Australia. And this man said, he's an American. He's an American citizen. The other man said he was born in Australia. And the reply was, well, just because you're born in a stable, you're not a horse. And I've never forgotten that to this day. But the Jeffers, the Sullivan and Corbett fight, when that came in, the newspaper on the train, the Fitzsimmons-Corbett fight, and I don't remember about the others. I guess I'd left home at that time. All these things came as a common denominator of my day. The early day when I was a little boy and running a greenhouse and things of that sort, and the later day, the bicycle day, I would call it, when I got into that extension of my activities. The return of the regiment from the Philippines was a very great day. They painted the street red, white, and blue for the company, the local company, and they turned the town upside down. They had arches made of coke. They had arches of bunting. They had other arches. And they gave these men everything they could in the way of hospitality, including drink. But very shortly after that, they failed to support the National Guard Company. So the remaining history, there was no National Guard Company from that town, which I thought was a very unfortunate thing. They began making money so fast that they didn't look into any of these things until the crack came, crash came, and everybody was next door, seemingly, to the poorhouse. But I was gone and forgotten at that time. But I saw great prosperity without realizing just what it meant. And I wasn't there in the days of extreme financial stress. I am trying to think of other periods there of my youth which would be interesting in recording the development of affairs. I always marched in the torchlight procession when they would allow me to, but I was pretty small for the purpose. I liked the William Jennings Bryan campaign because they gave me a gray hat and a cane, and I think I was about 14 then, and I walked in every Bryan celebration, very proud of myself with my cane and my gray fedora hat and the intense amusement of my mother. These things all seem very small. I had a very attractive coterie of friends, one or two of them who won great national prominence as athletes, particularly one who was the fullback on the Yale team, the pitcher on the Yale ball team, and the broad jumper on the Yale field team, all in his first year, and became very well known all over the country. He was just about my age, about a year older than I was, but my companion of my youth. There were several others that won great fame. We had a very interesting ball team. There was a lawyer there who was very fond of baseball and who had played on the Lafayette team. So he was a lawyer and busy, but he couldn't get away from his fondness for baseball, so he organized a team on which he played first base. And he got most of these boys, country boys. Well, it just happened he landed on two wonderful pitchers who afterwards made great records, one at Princeton in particular, and refused to go into national baseball because he got his education and became a doctor. The other fellow I met years and years afterwards when I went back for the first planned visit for me, and he was at the plane to meet me in his shirt sleeves, and I won't say any more on that. But this team that this lawyer organized had great success, and naturally, finally developed that he was getting a little old for the team, and they put in a young man playing first base, which rather broke his heart. And the management of the team was taken over, and while they were all volunteers, it in a sense became semi-professional, though there was no professional league at all. Then the trouble was to find anybody to play. They licked everybody, defeated everybody around them. And if my recollection is correct, though I may have got an exaggerated recollection of the circumstances, I know that this lawyer succeeded in getting Johnny Ward, the first baseman of the New York, to bring that team over when it was either first or second in the National League. And the Pittsburgh team, which was either first or second the same year, came over, and I don't know who its manager was, but I know its great pitcher was Red Arrett, who fascinated me because he kicked as high as his head when he made his delivery in pitching. They came over, and with the New York team was Russi, I think is his name, who was the great batter, who was supposed to pitch the fastest baseball of that day and maybe later, I don't know. But whatever it was, we had one colored man on the team, Hucker McClure, who played right field. And Hucker came to the bat his first time up against New York and knocked a home run off the famous Russi. I think Russi sort of slacked up on him, and the home run leaked out. Now, I'm not quite certain of the result, but my dim recollection is that they defeated New York. And I won't say they defeated Pittsburgh, too, but they gave them a rapid run for their money. However, these were destructive of the team because they were signed up all over the country and there was no team left. Most of the men went to colleges. Some went into professional football. And they were largely country boys. But that was the great interest at home, that ball team, and it was so completely destroyed there was never any fine ball team organized in the days of my youth after that. Well, I think I've given you everything but the murder trials, which I used to try to attend and got put out of the courthouse. But those were the activities of youth. One thing I delighted in was when the snow was on the ground and we could sled ride, and when it really got frozen up and the main roads, which are all macadam roads, sometimes not even that, could be used. One road cut right across the town over its main street. And when that got in excellent condition, they would put somebody on watch at Main Street in order to stop any traffic when a sled was coming down. And they had these big sleds they called panics, where the front part was connected in a loose way with the long slant of the sled, and where the head man sat with a skate on one foot and his legs crossed over and guided the sled and held on with two hands. Later on, a sled came out, which was purchased, and they still have it, I think, the flexible flyer. And they got me a rather large one, the largest size, the only two sizes I recall. And that was very fine. There was nothing like that in town. And we got a plank for it so that we could put on two extra people. And when these sled riding got really fine, and we could use this main road right across the town and on down and stop the traffic in the evening and on a moonlight night, my father would go and take a friend of his, and we liked that because the weight made the velocity of the sled much greater, and we had this board along the length which extended over the rear and allowed them to get a little bit out over that, and I sat in front with a skate on my foot or my chum, and my father would sit behind and was supposed to swing the sled, and we'd come down this road, and it had walks across the road which were built up, which really made jumpers, as we call them, and the sled would leap out from them, and you had to be very expert to see it prevent it from turning turtle when it landed on the other side of the crossing. But the whole town would turn out, and it was quite a fine sport to have all the men, old and young, and the boys all playing together, and playing together what it was. I saw in the Saturday Evening Post the other day an illustration in colors, of the local barber shop, apparently of this day, and apparently out in the West. A very amusing illustration, very expertly done. And I was reminded of my youth. There was one barber shop, as I recall, in the town. It was run by a Negro man who was quite a friend of mine, and he had about four Negro assistants, so he must have had about five chairs. And that was sort of a club. There was no club for men then in those days. There was no country club. There was no town club. The Elks Club had just gotten formed, but that wasn't much except on the Elk Night. And so there'd be a great deal of sitting in the barbershop where you could get all the news. And they didn't like the boys to come in there then because they liked all the chairs available for the men. And most of the men, as I recall, came there to get their shave in the daytime. Whether they shaved every day or not, I don't remember. But I know they got their shaves there and didn't shave at home, and there was no safety razor. Each one had his own cup with the soap, and his name was on the cup in very fanciful letters. So you could see the names of all the patrons in these cups in the rack, which interested me as a boy. And all these men came in, many of them around noontime to get their shave, many of them in the evening, after dinner, and then immediately after work in the afternoon. It was a very solid town in its ways. I remember that one young man there, a very attractive young man and fairly good fellow, as I recall, was almost blackballed because he didn't work. He had enough money to have some good horses. He rode horseback and drove good rigs. It was a beautiful country to do that in. And he'd organized a riding club which went up in the mountains. And he was rather taboo because he didn't work. And later on, he took a job at a plant that was about a mile out of town, and he'd have to walk down the railroad track a mile to that plant every day and walk back for lunch or eat out of a lunch pail and walk back again in the evening. And I think he really did it to take the curse off this taboo on him because he didn't work. Later on, there were many who didn't work, but they didn't improve the life of the town at all. If I think anything else that'll go with this, Or if this gives you an idea of what I should really furnish you in the way of information of these days, I will do it. I remember I got one lesson when I participated in a political parade for a governor of Pennsylvania. I don't remember who he was, but he was a Democratic candidate. And they had a tremendous to-do, and they had these torchlights and people cheering out the windows. And, of course, to me, he was just the governor of Pennsylvania-elect. Well, he was snowed under by a terrific vote which came largely out of Philadelphia and which was a very much a control vote. And I got my first lesson of politics there because my mother finally explained to me why, though this man was successful where we were and was successful in other places around, he was completely defeated by the political organization of the city of Philadelphia. I knew about everybody in town. I walked to everything I went to. I walked to school. I walked to these other things and seldom rode on the streetcar because they were always too short a ride to pay a nickel to get. But I always remember my mother going shopping and coming back to the house and getting off the streetcar, which was rather high up. The street hadn't been bricked yet, and it made it a little bit high above the Macadam Road. And she stepped off in the middle of a dogfight. We had two or three dogs there. My chum had a dog, and a strange dog had gotten involved, and our dogs had the bad habit of barking at the horses, and in this general melee, they were all fighting. My mother just stepped down in the middle of the fight. I remember she landed sitting, lost her hat and lost her basket, but even that didn't make her so mad because she was very fond of the dogs, and she recognized a dog did that. Ours weren't so well trained, but they were beautifully trained for shooting, which was their principal activity, which allowed them a considerable liberty in their ordinary dogdom. I think I'll call it today. All right?
Yes.
I'm going to send you this reel because I'd like to get your reactions as to what sort of thing I could give you. I know you want to print, don't want to print all this nonsense, but maybe you can get something from it. We'll give you a little eyesight into the life of the town in which I grew up. But I think that you can probably tell me better what it is you want, what it is you think would be suitable. And therefore, I'll close this reel right now and have it sent to you right away.
I can get it in the 5 o'clock mail now.